talking history. This is News Talk.
We shall fight on the beaches, we shall fight in the hills, we shall never surrender.
And out of that silence came thousands of voices.
The strategy of the white man has always been divide and conquer.
As one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Auch die Rollen, Argus, Akhoisa.
Good evening and welcome. We're talking history on News Talk 106 to 108 with me, Patrick Gagan. In tonight's show, we're looking at the good, the bad and the ugly of two iconic Irish presidential elections, 1990 and 1997. And we'll be finding out why these elections have become so divisive for the candidates. You can email us your thoughts and views, talkinghistory@newstalk.com, and we'd love to hear from you. This autumn, we have another Irish presidential election where we elect our head of state for a 7-year term. But since 1990, the elections have been, at times, nasty and brutish. In tonight's show, we want to look back at two of the most iconic presidential elections in Irish history, 1990 and 1997, and also find out about why there wasn't a presidential election between 1973 and 1990, as we explore the history of these iconic presidential elections. And to help me do this, I'm delighted to welcome our panel of experts. Dr. John Walsh teaches in the School of Education at Trinity College Dublin and is the author of Patrick Hillary, The Official Biography, and he's also a Labour councillor for the Castleknock electoral area. Professor Kevin Rafter is Professor of Political Communication at DCU and is an expert on the politics and media of modern Ireland, and he's the co-editor of The Irish Presidency, Power, Ceremony and Politics, which will be coming out in a second edition next year. Well, you're both very welcome. And Kevin, I might begin with you and a question about the 1990 election being seen as the turning point in Irish presidential history, the way you had male presidents up until then, everyone except Douglas Hyde being from Fianna Fáil. There hadn't been an election since 1973. And then a new era and a new interpretation of the presidency after that.
Yeah, and I suppose that it all started in January of 1990 when Dick Spring, he was the leader of the Labour Party, put a marker down and said, we will have a presidential election. If I can't find a candidate, I'll run myself. The Labour Party did find a candidate in a former senator, Mary Robinson, and she was in the field relatively early. I suppose, in a sense, a lot of people weren't giving the presidential election a lot of attention at that time. Nothing like what we see at the moment, because there hadn't been an election, as you say, since 1973. But Mary Robinson, quiet campaign in the spring and early summer, as she went around the country and introduced herself as a candidate and spoke about being a president of purpose, activism. She represented a very different Ireland to the representation of previous presidents. And also we must cast our mind back to 1990. Ireland was on the cusp of a period of considerable change. We'd come through the 1980s, Ireland was an economic basket case, immigration, unemployment. There had been moral and debates about abortion, divorce, contraception. This was a country where divorce was still it wasn't possible to introduce legislation on divorce in 1990. Homosexuality was criminalised and contraception access was limited. Mary Robinson had she was a liberal pluralist. She had been a politician who had campaigned for this new vision of Ireland in her period as a lawyer and a senator. And now she was bringing that to the presidential campaign. And she was offering a very different vision of Ireland through the presidency.
And now Mrs. Robinson will make her first speech as president of Ireland.
Agini Ushla, citizens of Ireland, Manona Heron, agus Fearna Heron, you have chosen me to represent you, and I am humbled and grateful for your trust. The Ireland I will be representing is a new Ireland, open, tolerant, inclusive. Many of you who voted for me did so without sharing all my views. This, I believe, is a significant signal of change, a sign, however modest, that we have already passed the threshold to a new pluralist Ireland. The recent revival of the old concept of the fifth province expresses this emerging Ireland of tolerance and empathy. The old Irish term for province is chiocid, meaning a fifth. And yet, as everyone knows, there are only four geographical provinces on this island. So where is the fifth? The fifth province is not anywhere here or there, north or south, east or west. It is a place within each one of us, that place that is open to the other, that swinging door which allows us to venture out and others to venture in. Ancient legends divided Ireland into four quarters and a middle, although they differed about the location of this middle or fifth province. While Tara was the political centre of Ireland, tradition has it that this fifth province acted as a second centre, a necessary balance. If I am to be a symbol of anything, I would like to be a symbol of this reconciling and healing fifth province.
And it's interesting what you're saying about Ireland being on the cusp of change, but it's still 1990, and Mary Robinson got embroiled in a big controversy in September because she gave an interview to Hot Press magazine, and it seems completely bizarre now that it would be controversial. But she was asked a question about the Virgin Megastore and whether she would, you know, as president, I think, officiate over the launch or something of some condoms, you know, display or sales that they were having, and she said she would, and that was hugely controversial, and people thought that was going to be the big scandal of the election.
Yeah, I was an undergraduate student in Trinity College at the time, and in the students' union they had a condom machine which was covered over with wire, and it was protected, and every so often the guards would come on the foot of a complaint and they'd take it away. So, you know, it was contraception had been a divisive issue. It was liberalised, but there wasn't full availability. So when Mary Robinson said, yeah, I'll open the stand in the Virgin Megastore down in the on the quays, it became a news story, and this was caught up, I suppose, in, like, it's a small example now when we reflect back, but it was caught up in that liberal conservative forward Ireland, the Ireland where the church had dominance. But it was even before the scandals was the control was beginning to crumble. And Mary Robinson, I suppose, even with her answer yes, she was saying something very different to any other president that had gone before, to most other politicians at the time, indeed.
And to remind our listeners, there are three candidates in this election. Brian Lenihan for Fianna Fáil, he's the Taoiseach, a very popular figure, I think a much loved figure, and he'd had his health problems and there was a huge amount of sympathy for him there with his operations and so on. Austin Curry running for Fine Gael, Mary Robinson running for Labour, and I think most people going into that thinking that Brian Lenihan was an absolute certainty and was definitely going to win. And of course, it didn't turn out like that. There was the huge crisis then over mature recollections and phone calls to the Oras and what happened. But Kevin, a question before that is, if that crisis and controversy hadn't erupted, do you think Mary Robinson had a chance of winning, and could she have won, or did it require the Fianna Fáil campaign to implode?
The implosion of the Fianna Fáil campaign through Lenihan and the tapes, and whether he had contacted the Oras or not in 1982, and subsequently Pádraig Flynn's contribution on radio when, you know, sexist comments towards Mary Robinson were uttered by him. Both of those issues certainly damaged the Lenihan campaign. He was the front runner, as you say, in a PR campaign where there are three candidates. Austin Curry of Fine Gael really hadn't taken off. His vote was going to be low. Would Mary Robinson have overtaken Brian Lenihan on the second counter? Would he have been so far ahead? The likelihood is that he was moving towards the Oras. He was the front runner. The Fianna Fáil campaign was moving nice and steady. He was well-liked, well-respected. He fit the prototype of the president at the time, you know, a distinguished political career, ministerial career, the elderly statesman. But, anybody that who's listening, whoever met or can recall Brian Lenihan Sr., you know, he was incredibly good company, and he was very popular. I think the Robinson campaign had exceeded all expectations. She had done really, really well. But whether those two controversies that upset Lenihan and Fianna Fáil, if they hadn't happened. Look, it's the what if of Irish politics, and certainly what would have happened thereafter would have been very different, you know, because Lenihan, not that he was an arch conservative, but he represented old politics and old Ireland. And the Mary Robinson, the 7 years that she was in the Oras, they wouldn't have happened. Lenihan's period would have been much different. And that would have, I think, maybe tilted the country in a different direction as well. But the controversies definitely helped her campaign.
And we will talk about those controversies. But it is interesting looking at the figures. Brian Lenihan got 44%. 7 years later, Mary McAleese, running for Fianna Fáil, won and got 45%. So the difference, I think, for me is that in 1997, Mary McAleese was very transfer friendly. And there was a lot of candidates and she was getting second preferences from everywhere. I do think the controversies in 1990 made Brian Lenihan transfer unfriendly. So
yeah, but remember, Mary Robinson got 39% of the first preference vote. It was Austin Curry bombed as the Fine Gael candidate. And I suppose what we did have on the ballot paper then was different visions, not just of the presidency and the office, but of representations of Ireland that was going to go into the 1990s. And whether or not Robinson won or not, I think the election in itself had huge political consequences.
Had huge political consequences. So, John, let's talk about the controversies then. And your historical figure, Patrick Hillary, and you have the brilliant book on Patrick Hillary. Patrick Hillary, the outgoing president, is in a way central to this story because it involved, the first scandal involved phone calls that were made to the Oras back in 1982 when he was there.
That's right. Towards the end of Hillary's first term as president, it was a period of particular political instability. There were three general elections in an 18-month period in 1981 and 1982. And it was after the Garrett Fitzgerald's Fine Gael Labour coalition fell on the budget on a vote over children's shoes. It was the budget was defeated. And as the outgoing Taoiseach, Garrett Fitzgerald was coming to the Oras to seek a dissolution of the Dáil. And Charles Haughey, who was leader of Fianna Fáil, contacted the Oras. He sent a number of phone calls to the Oras and instigated phone calls by others to say that he did not wish the Dáil to be dissolved. And the first call, roughly 10 calls were made over the course of a two-hour period, first by Haughey himself. Then he enlisted Brian Lenihan. And the Clare TD, Sylvester Barrett, who knew Hillary, was a former constituency colleague of Hillary's. And Lenihan and Barrett sought to meet Hillary on the basis that they wished to see the president to discuss a private matter. And obviously the private matter they wanted to discuss didn't require any powers of deduction on the night that the government had fallen. Lenihan made two further calls to check whether his and Haughey's messages had been passed to the president. That was really the extent of Lenihan's involvement. And Hillary regarded Lenihan's involvement as basically harmless. He had no issue with what Lenihan had done. He was very angry with Haughey, because Haughey then proceeded to send a message, to dictate a message to Captain Barber, who was the young captain, was the aide-de-camp in Oras an Uachtaráin that night. He was effectively acting as, he was receiving the messages. And Haughey dictated a message saying, "I wish to speak to the president on a constitutional matter, and it is urgent, and I propose to call to the Oras at 10:30 to see the president. Please inform the president I will wait for his answer." So that was a very uncompromising message, an attempt to pressure the president. What Haughey was seeking, of course, was for the president to refuse to dissolve the Dáil, and under an obscure article of the Constitution, which had never been used, to refuse to dissolve the Dáil, which would have led immediately to the resignation of Garrett Fitzgerald as Taoiseach and would have allowed the Dáil a new government to be formed in the Dáil, and how he hoped he had the numbers to form a new government.
So why did this then become a big crisis and a big controversy in 1990?
Well, I suppose there's a couple of reasons. The first thing to say was that Hillary had refused to answer any of the messages. And in fact, the only thing he did was to give a message to Captain Barber to say, tell him I do not think it appropriate to speak to him. But he did tell the staff, in fact, he was concerned enough to tell the staff to bar the gates of the Oris in case Haughey attempted to come up. So there was a lot of tension at the time. That became public almost immediately. Journalists published articles within a week saying phone calls had been made to the Oris to pressure the president. So that was in the public domain for 8 years. But it came to a head in 1990 because Brian Lenihan, who was then at the Taoiseach and a candidate for the presidency, had given a research interview to a student called Jim Duffy. And in the interview with Jim Duffy, Brian Lenihan had said that phone calls were made, and it said actually that he spoke to the president and the president was very angry. Now, in fact, Hillary was amazed by that because nobody got through to the president. Hillary refused to speak to anyone because that was constitutionally the proper thing to do, and he refused Haughey's requests. But obviously, Brian Lenihan gave that account to the researcher, Jim Duffy. That then, through a complex set of circumstances, let's say, became public. And Brian Lenihan and Charles Haughey had consistently denied that any calls had ever been made. And they continued to deny that through the presidential campaign. And Hillary was friends with Lenihan, didn't blame him for what had happened, and later said to me, like, well, I don't understand why Brian didn't just say, of course I tried to ring him, I didn't get through, like, what's the problem, and tried to make light of it.
But instead he gave a very bad news, I think it was a 6 o'clock news interview, where he used that infamous phrase on mature recollection, he didn't recall, but it looked like he wasn't really sure, and he seemed hesitant and uncertain, and it didn't settle the issue, it just seemed to make it even more confusing.
That's right. I mean, what was really damaging to Brian Lenihan's campaign was that he went on the 6-1 News, RTE, in an attempt to defuse the issue. And he said that, you know, on mature recollection, the earlier account he'd given was wrong, and that he was now saying no phone calls had been made. And that was a complete disaster. And it sent the Fianna Fáil campaign into a tailspin. Attempts were made to draw Hillary. Lenihan then said immediately after that he would speak to the president. And he tried to enlist Hillary to support his version of events. And Hillary was horrified by that and flatly refused to get involved. Actually, on a personal level, Hillary appears to have been sympathetic to Lenihan, but he was determined to keep the presidency out of the controversy. And he also reflected that anything that he said would actually have been damaging to Lenihan, because the only thing he could have done was confirm that various phone calls had been made to Áras an Uachtaráin in January 1982.
And then to add to all of this then, Fianna Fáil was in a coalition government with the Progressive Democrats. They threatened to support this vote of no confidence unless something happened. And Charles Haughey tried to get Lenihan to resign. He refused. And so he was sacked on the 31st of October as Taoiseach. And then that added another dimension to the campaign.
That's right. If anything, and I remember I was in school during the campaign. And it's one of my first political memories. But if anything, Lenihan's sacking perhaps paradoxically strengthened his campaign. I think it did. There was polling after the interviews, after the mature recollection statement, which showed Mary Robinson ahead by 20%.
Yes, Jim.
Extraordinary.
Yeah, it is extraordinary. Jim, I like John, I went back over the newspapers and looked at the coverage at that time. And, you know, one of the opinion polls after the mature recollection interview had Mary Robinson on 53%. And people were saying she will win on the first count. And I think John is right. I think the sacking probably led to a groundswell of sympathy for him. It ensured that the Fianna Fáil vote definitely came out and supported him. But for a time after that, it looked like Brian Lenihan was finished.
It did. His credibility was significantly undermined by the tapes controversy, the flip-flopping on what he'd actually done, you know, the fact that he doubled down on the denial, said he was under heavy medication at the time, and that had impacted his recollection. And then the intervention of the Progressive Democrats, the fact that the campaign then came into the political domain, they insisted that he be removed from government, and when he wouldn't resign, he was sacked by Haughey. That did bring a degree of sympathy, as John has said, for Lenehan. And then Pádraig Flynn intervened.
Let's talk about Pádraig Flynn's intervention, because this is the 3rd of November, just days before the election. Pádraig Flynn is on a radio programme on RTE, Saturday View. Michael McDougall of the Progressive Democrats is on as well. I think Brendan Howlin of the Labour Party. And Pádraig Flynn, for some extraordinary unknown reason, makes the most incredible, unwise, ill-judged intervention in Irish political history.
Yeah, in the, I suppose, that period just before the end of the campaign and the, just before the weekend interview, Fianna Fáil had been running sort of Red Scare tactics with Mary Robinson. She was a socialist, hard left. So that's the theme, that's the attack that Fianna Fáil are going with. And Flynn took it a degree higher when he went on radio. And I suppose in some ways he lost the run of himself, but he seriously damaged the Lenehan campaign. He criticised Mary Robinson for her new clothes, her new look, her new hairdo. He said she had no interest in the family, in being a mother, and all that kind of thing. And then he went a step further and personalised it by saying, you know, none of us who knew Mary Robinson very well in previous incarnations ever heard her claiming to be a great wife or a mother. And, you know, even pause to, you know, when you would say it today, like just how sexist that is. Michael McDougall, as you said, was on the radio.
And he was brilliant.
He smelt blood. He pounced and he effectively, that intervention from McDougall was as damning as Flynn's words, because he just took them and undermined Flynn totally. And Flynn later apologised, but the damage was done. And in many ways, that's where the transfers come in. And when we look at the election, there are people who would not have voted for Brian Lenehan after that. But not only with even people who were voting for Austin Curry, they voted number two for Mary Robinson. And on the second count, she won. So I think the tapes controversy was one of those events that I think Lenehan could possibly have recovered from. But the Flynn radio interview, and again, I think it goes back to the earlier comments about it did go to the heart of what this presidential election in 1990 represented. Old Ireland, New Ireland, Conservative Ireland, Liberal Ireland. The role of women in Irish society, the fact that there was a woman running for president was usually symbolic. And here was a politician, a senior member of government, close associate of the Taoiseach, and he's talking about her role as a wife and a mother. It's not even the fact that he's criticising it, but he's actually bringing it into the domain of the political campaign. So 1990 is that cusp moment, to my mind, in terms of Irish politics, and the presidential election is a really good illustrative example if you ever want to think about how does Ireland change. And the Flynn interview is a wonderful example, a case study of a politician who was really out of step, and Pádraig Flynn was out of step with his contribution, and Michael McDougall just went for the juggler.
And Mary Robinson went on to win the election, and we haven't looked back since. So we're going to take a quick break now. When we come back, we'll be exploring the fact that there wasn't an election, a presidential election between 1973 and 1990. And we'll find out why, and also talk about the presidency of Patrick Hillary. So stay with us here on News Talk. Welcome back. We're talking history, and tonight we are talking about iconic Irish presidential elections. My panel of experts, Dr. John Walsh of the School of Education at Trinity College Dublin and the author of Patrick Hillary, the official biography, and Professor Kevin Rafter, Professor of Political Communication at DCU and the co-editor of The Irish Presidency, Power, Ceremony and Politics. So, John, if we can begin by talking about the fact that there isn't a presidential election in Ireland between 1973 and 1990. So that's a long time. And what that means is, you know, Erskine Childers beats Tom O'Higgins in 1973. Erskine Childers dies in office after a year. Cúrúla Dálaig is elected unopposed. And then he resigns in 1976 over that thundering disgrace episode. And Patrick Hillary then, for Fianna Fáil, is returned unopposed. And he's re-elected unopposed in 1983. And I suppose the question is, did that damage Patrick Hillary's presidency, the fact that he didn't have a mandate of his own?
Well, Patrick, the first thing probably to be said is that the political establishment during that period was particularly keen to avoid an election. And Patrick Hillary, as you said, was nominated twice unopposed. And I think there's no doubt that not having a mandate, not having contested an election and won it, definitely restricted Hillary's room for manoeuvre. And it denied him perhaps leverage that he might otherwise have had with the government. And Hillary certainly always felt that the level of support for the presidency during his term was poor to the point of emaciation. The allowance was relatively small. There was no press officer in Áras an Uachtaráin, and he only had a very small staff. But certainly having had a mandate of his own would have given him perhaps more political strength to address that.
And in your book, you have some great material about Patrick Hillary using his own presidential allowance to help increase the wages of his staff and using some of his own salary to help them, that they were so underpaid that he was so ashamed that he was diverting using these resources to make sure that they did have a fair wage.
That's right. I mean, when Hillary took office, the presidential allowance was only 15,000. Even at the time in the 1970s, that was it was inadequate. And the salaries of the staff were meant to be drawn from that. So, I mean, that was an unsustainable situation. Hillary was initially unable to get the government to rectify that, partly because I think Liam Cosgrave, who was the Taoiseach, feared that the optics were bad in the run-up to a general election in 1977, that if the government gave more money to the presidency, it would look bad. And as a short-term measure, Hillary diverted some of the presidential salary dipped into his own salary, essentially, to fund the staff in Áras an Uachtaráin to support the staff, which is an extraordinary situation for a president to be in. And then he did succeed in reaching a compromise with Jack Lynch when Jack Lynch became Taoiseach in 1977. Jack Lynch was initially willing to increase the presidential allowance to 30,000, still a fairly modest increase, but he backed away from that because he feared that it would impact on national pay negotiations. So instead, Hillary and Lynch reached a compromise, which was that the salaries of the staff were taken out of the presidential allowance and they were paid directly by the government. They were paid directly by a government department.
And is there a sense that Patrick Hillary, as president, wanted to make sure that the presidency wasn't involved in any controversy? Because there had been that huge controversy in 1976 when a president felt forced to resign. And I think Ruaidhrí Dáileg, you know, was probably right to resign because you had a minister, Paddy Donegan, calling him a thundering disgrace. The Taoiseach not accepting Donegan's resignation when it was offered and kind of not really denouncing it in strong enough language and perhaps saying that the point was there was some, you know, point that he was trying to make, and that it did leave the president in an untenable position. And I think that was a shameful episode.
No, absolutely. And there's no question that Carol O'Donoghue was shamefully treated. And certainly Paddy Hillary said that when Paddy Hillary was nominated as president unopposed in November 1976 after O'Donoghue's resignation, he said that O'Donoghue had no alternative but to resign, and he was treated disgracefully. And in fact, the perhaps a key issue with the statement made by Paddy Donegan was firstly that apparently the thundering disgrace was a euphemism. What he actually said couldn't be repeated on and still can't be repeated on a family programme. But also he made a more serious criticism because President O'Donoghue had referred the Emergency Powers Act to the Supreme Court.
Which is part of his constitutional right?
Absolutely. I mean, President O'Donoghue acted absolutely correctly. Now, it was a time of great turmoil. The British ambassador had been assassinated by the Provisional IRA. The coalition government had brought forward an emergency powers bill. And O'Donoghue rightly referred that to the Supreme Court to make sure it was in line with the Constitution. But Donegan, in his speech, said not only did he insult the president, but he said that the president had to stand behind the state. So in effect, he was saying that the president as commander-in-chief had failed to show loyalty to the state. Now, that was an incendiary criticism.
And the fact that he was doing it at an army barracks and the president as, you know, this titular commander of the forces.
Absolutely. I mean, there was O'Donoghue regarded it, understandably, as a constitutional clash, that his role as commander-in-chief had been called into question. and that an apology, Donegan apologised pretty quickly. He was willing to resign. Liam Cosgrave refused his resignation and stood over his, supported Donegan in a confidence motion in the Dáil, where the government won the confidence motion, but they clearly lost the argument.
And is that why they didn't put anyone forward in the election? Is that why they were happy to accept Patrick Hillary, because they had made such a mess of things with the Donegan affair, and they realised they had no chance if they put forward a Fine Gael or a Labour candidate?
Yeah, absolutely. The government parties, and particularly Fine Gael, were happy to avoid a presidential election. Hillary was put, Carola Dolig was an agreed candidate for the presidency. Hillary was actually put forward as a Fianna Fáil candidate, but the government parties, Fine Gael and Labour, announced that they wouldn't contest the election. They were quite concerned to avoid an election.
Now, Patrick Hillary is often seen as a grey figure, a grey president, you know, representing just how the presidency had turned into a retirement home for politicians before Mary Robinson was elected in 1990 and changed everything. But up until his election as president, he actually had this really very distinguished career. He was a European commissioner. He was a very successful minister for education and for industry and commerce and for labour and for external affairs. He was someone who was talked about as a possible leader of Fianna Fáil and a possible Taoiseach. That this was someone who had a hugely impressive CV.
No, absolutely. And Hillary was a very effective politician. And in some ways, I think his time as presidency, especially his second term, probably tarnished his reputation unfairly, but he was a very effective minister. I think he probably had a very significant impact as a policy innovator on the Irish state in two ways. I mean, firstly, as Minister for Education, he took the lead in bringing forward major education reforms, which were later taken forward by Donal O'Malley. And he was really kind of initiated major reforms like the creation of comprehensive and community schools. And then secondly, as European Commissioner, he was the first European Commissioner to bring forward a social action programme. In other words, to like bring forward meaningful European legislation in the area of employment, employment rights, rights for migrants, which in fact he didn't succeed in getting the Commission to fully accept. So he was a groundbreaking figure as a European Commissioner, and a precursor in many ways for the Delors Commission, the radical the social Europe measures brought forward by Jacques Delors. So he was a very significant political figure, and he was only 53 when he became president. So he wasn't actually, I mean, there's often a view that he was in all these older men, but in fact Hillary wasn't. He took a to some extent, Hillary made a I think Dennis Coughlan in the Irish Times rightly said he made a sacrifice by accepting the presidency because he cut off any further political career.
And John, this isn't directly related to presidential elections, but it could have led to a change in the presidency. In 1979, at the time of the visit of Pope John Paul II to Ireland, a sex scandal in inverted commas broke out, and it appeared that Patrick Hillary might resign as president and someone else would take over. And it was the most extraordinary story I think I've ever come across. And you deal with it so brilliantly in your book. So what was this sex scandal?
So it was an incredible story. And like obviously in the middle of, as you said, Pope John Paul II's visit to Dublin, which in some ways is, the last high point of traditional Ireland. Over two million people coming out to see the Pope. He was welcomed obviously by Patrick Hillary, who was the president. But in the middle of the visit, a rumor started circulating. There were about 2,000 journalists in Dublin for the visit, and a rumor started circulating that President Hillary was about to resign because he was having an extramarital affair with two women. And different versions of the rumour suggested that, you know, one of the women was actually living with him in Oras an Uachtaráin. There were various wild and lurid stories circulating. Now, no journalist was ever able to produce any evidence to suggest an extramarital affair. There was no evidence whatsoever. But the rumours proliferated in a kind of febrile atmosphere. And Hillary himself said a rumour was like the shark. It was impossible to control, and you know the shark always gets his prey was his comment.
And Patrick, Hillary, I was talking about this on The Hard Shoulder with Kieran Cudahy. We're doing this series on the Irish presidency. And we both found it the most extraordinary sequence of events. And the fact that Patrick Hillary decided to hold a press conference as a way of killing the story, even though most people in Ireland knew nothing about the story.
Yeah, so initially Hillary was told by a close friend that Hibernia magazine was going to publish a story that he was about, his marriage had, was breaking up and he was about to resign. And initially his reaction was that the story was ludicrous and wouldn't be taken seriously. He didn't see how anyone believed that the president would be able to conduct a clandestine affair. But in fact, as the story circulated further, while he managed to ignore the story for the duration of the papal visit, but the 2 days following the Pope's departure from Dublin saw frenzied behind-the-scenes activity where journalists were rushing to check the story, and there was a lot of behind-the-scenes activity between Hillary and Jack Lynch, who was the Taoiseach, and Jack Lynch urged him to address the story. And Lynch, in fact, offered... Lynch said to him, "We'll have to deny this. It's very strong." And Lynch had offered to brief the editors of RTE and at the time the three major daily papers, the Irish Times, Irish Independent and Irish Press, on the president's behalf. But Hillary insisted on speaking to the editors personally. And that was probably against the advice of Lynch and Lynch's press secretary, Frank Dunlop. But Hillary felt that he had to... Hillary believed that silence from the park would be misinterpreted and that he had something to hide. He also spoke to Gerard Fitzgerald, who was leader of Fine Gael, and Frank Klusky, leader of the Labour Party, and both of them supported his decision to go public. Now, he didn't intend to have a press conference at all initially. And I suppose this reflected perhaps a certain naivety on Hillary's part. It also reflected the fact there was no press officer in Oras an Uachtaráin.
He thought he could talk to the editors and they would have a word with the journalists. But this was post-Watergate and editors were very careful about everything being done in the right way. And so he ended up speaking to a load of journalists, and Sean Tignan was there about to go off and talk on the 9 o'clock news. Brian Farrell had a programme ready to go if he did resign, just as backup. And as I say, really the most extraordinary press conference possibly in Irish political history.
Absolutely. So first he met the editors. He called the editors to the Oros, and it was on the 3rd of October, Wednesday the 3rd of October, 1979. He had a private meeting with the editors, but the meeting did not go well. And the editor said that they advised the president to hold a press conference. And at that point, he had no alternative but to go ahead with the press conference. The press conference was the most dramatic and sensational media briefing, I think, still to this day, given by an Irish head of state. Kind of ironically, given Hillary's own reputation as quite a low-key politician. So he made a brief statement where he said, "I've only one statement, that is that I am not going to resign." He did then answer questions about his personal life and his marriage, which he dismissed those rumours, and he said they were absolutely without foundation, and there was no reason why he should not stay in the presidency.
And there was a great outpouring of public support for him, and the newspapers all ran editorials in favour of him. Young Michael D. Higgins, who was the chairman of the Labour Party, came out saying, that it was disgraceful the way people were probing into a person's private life, and came out very strongly defending him. And that put the controversy to bed. But I wonder, what was the thinking behind it? One of the rumours you mentioned in your book was that the KGB were behind it because they wanted to destabilise the Pope's visit to Ireland. There's also speculation that Charles Haughey was behind it as a way of to force Patrick Hillary to resign, and in that way, was it damage Jack Lynch's Taoiseach?
So all sorts of wild rumours circulated, and maybe the most, the wildest was undoubtedly a foreign affairs directorate of the KGB had engineered the rumours so as to discredit John Paul II on his visit to Dublin, and that Hillary was just collateral damage. Hillary found that quite ludicrous. And he said that he spoke subsequently to the Russian ambassador, and the Russian ambassador at a diplomatic reception raised a glass of vodka to him and said to the victim of the KGB. So that one he gave no credence to. A slightly more superficially plausible maybe was an editorial, a story that it might have been the British intelligence services. And that was spread by the Irish Press, who issued a blistering editorial saying it was the Dirty Tricks Brigade were at work. But again, that wasn't credible. I mean, there was no reason for MI5 or British intelligence to try to discredit the Irish president. So the story that Hillary himself believed was that the rumour was instigated either by Charles Haughey or by close advisors to Haughey. And at the time, Charles Haughey was, I suppose, he was a cabinet minister. He was minister for health and social welfare. And he was more or less openly campaigning for the leadership of Fianna Fáil. Jack Lynch was the Taoiseach. And Hillary was told by a number of sources, including Dennis Kennedy, a journalist in the Irish Times, by a senior army officer who remained anonymous, and a number of others, that the rumours didn't come from the KGB. They came from the heart of government, and they came from the heart of Fianna Fáil.
And what was the thinking to force Jack Lynch out? Or perhaps one theory that I think you suggest is that if Hillary resigned, perhaps Jack Lynch could have been persuaded to become president, and that would have created a vacancy at Taoiseach that perhaps Charles Haughey believed he would be able to move into and fill.
Yeah, that's that story surfaced in the media shortly after the rumours. That the purpose of the rumours was to force Hillary to resign so that Jack Lynch could then be placed under pressure to go to the park, and that would trigger the leadership contest between Charles Haughey and George Colley, which Haughey was confident of winning. And of course he was right. Haughey was correct in that, and he did defeat George Colley when the leadership contest happened in December 1979. So Hillary was convinced that Haughey was behind the rumours. He said the thoroughness of it was Haughey. And one of the reasons he was convinced was that when Haughey was elected Taoiseach, he had, you know, an amicable conversation with Hillary when he accepted the seals of office, and Hillary asked him to appoint a press officer for the Oras. And Haughey made a general statement saying, well, that's not really needed, sure, that's all over now anyway. And that triggered Hillary's suspicions.
Kevin, it is an extraordinary story from 1979, and I think they needed someone like you there to provide good media advice and good political communication advice, because, well, it could have been something that no one knew about into a major scandal and story.
Yeah, and it's remarkable how it is one of those episodes of the Hillary presidency that, you know, when you say the presidency of Patrick Hillary, the two terms that he served, and it's that scandal that wasn't a scandal that jumps to the fore. And it is remarkable. Again, a different media world. John mentioned that, you know, the editors of the three national newspapers, you know, a national television service, no internet. Can you imagine if this was a story today? You wouldn't even get to the opportunity to have the editors of all of the various national media organisations to the Oras, because somebody would have put it up on social media. So it's interesting looking back just how, I suppose, in a sense, how changed our politics has become because of the changed communication world.
Well, we're going to take a quick break now, but when we come back, we'll be looking at the 1997 election, where you had five candidates, including the first candidates nominated through the county council route, and we'll be finding out what happened then. So stay with us here on News Talk.
Aushla, la staro le shon, na me heal fain, the seal of winchera, or the seal of chira, gulier. Is privilege for you, a very tough amar up there on the heron, the vegov, the heron, again, is he gonga. This is a historic day in the life of my family and in the life of the country. It is a wonderful privilege for me to be chosen as up there on the heron, to be a voice for Ireland at home and abroad. I'm honoured and very humbled to be successor to seven exemplary presidents. Their differing religious, political, geographical and social origins speak loudly of a presidency which has always been wide open, all embracing. Among them were present presidents from Connacht, Leinster and Munster, to say nothing of America and London. It is my special privilege and delight to be the first president from Ulster. The span of almost 60 years since the first presidential inauguration has seen a nation transformed, This Ireland, which stands so confidently on the brink of the 21st century and the third millennium, is one our forebears dreamed of and yearned for. A prospering Ireland, accomplished, educated, dynamic, innovative, compassionate, proud of its people, its language, and of its vast heritage. An Ireland at the heart of the European Union, respected by nations and cultures across the world. The scale of what we have already accomplished in such a short time allows us to embrace the future with well-based confidence and hope. It is the people of Ireland who, in a million big and small ways, in quiet acts of hard work, heroism, and generosity, have built up the fabric of home, community, and country on which the remarkable success story of today's Ireland is built.
Welcome back. We're talking history, and tonight we are talking about some of the most iconic Irish presidential elections. I'm rejoined by Dr. John Walsh, who teaches in the School of Education at Trinity College Dublin and is the author of Patrick Hillary, the official biography, and he's also a Labour councillor for the Castleknock electoral area, and Professor Kevin Rafter, who's professor of political communication at DCU and is an expert on the politics and media of modern Ireland, and he's the co-editor of The Irish Presidency, Power, Ceremony and Politics, which will be coming out in a second edition next year. Kevin, talk to us about the 1997 election, because you have five candidates and it is the first time you have candidates nominated through the county council route with Dana and with Derek Nally. And it really is, it's an interesting election because not only do you have Mary McAleese elected and she goes on to be such an incredibly successful and distinguished president, but it's also an incredibly nasty and vicious election. And I remember Owen Harris writing the piece calling Mary McAleese a tribal time bomb in the run-up to it. But everyone seems to have been targeted and everyone seems to have been attacked. And it really, 1990 was a bit of a blood sport, but really from 1997 on, it almost created that precedent then that every Irish presidential election was just going to be open season on the candidates.
Yeah, and the reason it is open season on the candidates, and I think that's fair, is because it's an office that it's the individual, it's because they're going to represent the country, and they get tested in the campaign, their character, who they are, and the public want to know who they are, who's this person we're going to put in the arras. And that was the case in 1997. It was a fraught campaign. It was a fraught campaign in the selection process for some of the parties, and Fianna Fáil in particular. It was historic because of Dan and Derek Nally, the former Garda representative, coming through the council route. And then the campaign itself was bitter, divisive and very personalised. If we step back a little bit, the internal Fianna Fáil selection, it was to be Albert Reynolds, former Taoiseach. He was the front runner. The summer months of 97, there'd been a lot of internal quiet campaigning going on in Fianna Fáil, and this woman, Mary McAleese, had emerged as an alternative option. She had run for Fianna Fáil previously in a general election unsuccessfully. She was a former journalist with RTE. She'd been involved in the New Ireland Forum advising the Catholic Church, and she'd carved out a niche in Northern Ireland, which was her home, as an academic. And she's had the support of Ahern and a lot of the senior Fianna Fáil figures. In my previous life as a journalist, I was working in RTE, was presenting the This Week radio programme on Sundays, and I was there in Leinster House on the day that Mary McAleese beat Albert Reynolds, and she secured the nomination. It was the middle of September, so she was late coming into the field. So even before we get to the campaign proper, we have a bitter, divisive selection process within Fianna Fáil. Fine Gael went with Mary Bonatti. She was an MEP. She came from a distinguished political party. She was a sister of Nora Owen. And I, in many ways, the campaign was Mary McAleese versus Mary Bonatti. But at the very start, it wasn't, because Labour went with Aidy Roach, who was running an NGO. She had a reputation as a campaigner against for nuclear disarmament. And Interesting, Labour had an option with Michael D. Higgins in 1997, but the party hierarchy went with Eddie Roach. And in an early opinion poll, she had a commanding lead, and it looked like Labour were about to repeat the success of 1990. And they're doing well in early polls. But actually then when they're tested and they crumble a little bit, or the people say, well, actually, we don't want that person to represent us, they go elsewhere.
Although, John, some of the stuff that was being brought up was completely unfair and inappropriate, and the way things were thrown at candidates, it just seemed that it went beyond the bounds of what was perhaps, you know, fair comment.
Yeah, I think the 1997 presidential election was particularly vitriolic. And that impacted various candidates. But I think Eddie Roach got particularly rough treatment. She had been, as Kevin said, you know, very involved in children's charities. She was the head of the Chernobyl's children's charity. That work was undermined, and she was attacked. She was attacked about that. And a presidential campaign is a merciless business.
Merciless business, and you see that with later campaigns. Then with some of the people who were candidates still now talking about it and saying how scarred they have been because of it and how much of an impact it had on their lives. That there were people who were hugely respected figures in the community before they ran for president, and then they find themselves completely demoralised and effectively kind of humiliated by the end of it because their whole life and their whole reputation and career has been torn apart.
I think it is reasonable that presidential candidates are tested, and certainly people have a high. Since the 1990 presidential election, which was transformative, it certainly transformed the role of the and profile of the presidency. I think people have a high threshold in what they're looking for in a president, and they're particularly concerned that the president can represent Ireland in a credible way abroad.
And I think part of that, Patrick, as well, is it's the response to the attacks, it's the response to the scrutiny. And people can wander in and think, I could be president. That's all well and good, but this is an important job. It's a political job. It's a non-political office, doesn't have executive power, but it's a political job, and the campaign is very political. So candidates that don't have a political background, and it's interesting, those that have come through, if you look at our three recent presidents, they've all had considerable political experience in different ways. So for the untested, who may have been great and good in other worlds, but suddenly to have that focus on them, the communications, the media, and the attacks, their opponents attacking them. How they respond then is quite important. And Eddie Roach folded. Mary McAleese in 1997 had similar attacks, and she responded in a different way. She showed a toughness. And once Eddie Roach was out of the field in 1997, as I say, it became a two-horse race, two-candidate race between Bonatti and McAleese, and the Fianna Fáil candidate was the leader in the polls. But the defining moment in that campaign was also when there were attacks on Mary McAleese in relation to Northern Ireland, and her response was toughness. And in a sense, I think what the electorate then looked and said, well, actually, that person has the backbone to be president. And that's really why I think the scrutiny, while it can be vitriolic, yes, but I actually think it's fair, because we're testing this person to see, is this person suitable to be in the RS and to represent us?
Well, I think that's a very good note on which to end our discussion tonight, because we do have a presidential election coming up very soon, and the candidates are certainly all going to be tested in the weeks ahead. My thanks to Professor Kevin Rafter, Professor of Political Communication at DCU. He's the co-editor of the Irish Presidency, Power, Ceremony and Politics, and a new edition of that book will come out next year when the result of this election is known. And my thanks also to Dr. John Walsh of the School of Education at Trinity College Dublin, the author of Patrick Hillary, the official biography, and he's also a Labour councillor for the Castleknock electoral area. Well, that does bring us to the end of another edition of Talking History. My thanks to my producer, Mairéis O'Sullivan, for bringing everything together. Hope you can join us next week for more debate and discussion. We've been Talking History. Good night.